which he dares not cut out at once, lest he bleed to death, with the promise, nevertheless, that cutting may begin at the end of a given time. In recent decades, Lincoln argued, with the line of the Missouri Compromise firmly in place, slavery had seemed to be on the wane. The time for excising the when, returning the ideals set forth in the Declaration of Independence, was in sight at last. But now, with the line of compromise rescinded by this disastrous law, slavery had been transformed into a sacred right, suddenly placed on the high road to extension and perpetuity. And with a pat on its back, the law says to it, "Go, and Godspeed you." To demonstrate the thorny problem created by removing the imaginary line that has separated the country north and south and a prohibited expansion of slavery north of latitude 36 degrees, 30 minutes, Lincoln had developed a string of metaphors drawn from the worlds of farming, pastures, fences, and livestock. Imagine, Lincoln suggested, two adjacent farms with a dividing fence between them. Suddenly, one farmer, whose prairie grass had dried up, removed the fence so his famished cattle could feed on his neighbor's meadow. "You rascal," protested the neighbor, "what have you done?" The farmer replied, "I've taken down your fence, but nothing more. It is my true intent and meaning not to drive my cattle into your meadow, nor to exclude them therefrom, but to leave them perfectly free to form their own notions of the feed, and to direct their movements in their own way." No person in the audience failed to comprehend the analogy between this parable and Douglas's deceitful claim that by removing the line, there was no intent to bring slavery into Northern Territory. The figurative language Lincoln used was designed to let the people see for themselves the profoundly threatening aspects of the Nebraska law, just as he had sought to make each jury believe that they, and not he, were trying the case. Having brought his listeners to understand the impasse created by the new law, he was then able to suggest a way forward. The Nebraska Act must be repealed. The Missouri Compromise must be restored. The doctrine of self-government, as set forth in the Declaration of Independence, is right, absolutely and eternally right, declared Lincoln. But to apply it, as Douglas proposed, to extend slavery, perverted its very meaning. To allow slavery into new territory where it did not already exist by the original bargain of the Constitution would spark an open war with the spirit of concession and compromise that had marked the history of the Union. "Let us return slavery to the position our fathers gave it," Lincoln implored. This was no abolitionist credo. First and last, the credo was containment. And arguing against the Nebraska Act, Lincoln made it clear that he had no prejudice against the Southern people. They are just what we would be in their situation. If slavery did not now exist amongst them, they would not introduce it. If it did exist amongst us, we should not instantly give it up. But if empathy allowed Lincoln to comprehend the difficulty of dealing with slavery where it already existed, and with all humility he confessed that he had no easy solution to resolve that dilemma, he considered the annulment of the Missouri line a violent act that, if not reversed, might well lead to the destruction of the Union. "The choice we face," he told them, "is all of ours together. If we allow the Kansas-Nebraska Act to stand, if we allow slavery to spread, then the hope of America and all that it means to the whole world will be extinguished. But if we join together, we shall not only have saved the Union, but we shall have saved it as to make and to keep it forever worthy of the saving." The whole house was still as death, the Springfield Journal observed. And when he finished, the audience approved the glorious triumph of truth by loud and continued huzzas. Contemporary accounts considered Lincoln's speech the most accessible, persuasive, and profound argument ever made against the extension of slavery. He penetrated his subject with deep insight and carried his listeners along to his way of thinking. What persuaded and changed minds was the sincerity, clarity, conviction, and passion of the story he told. The inspiration that possessed him took possession of his hearers also, a young reporter noted. His speaking went to the heart because it came from the heart. I've heard celebrated orators who could start thunders of applause without changing any man's opinion. Mr. Lincoln's eloquence was of the higher type, which produced conviction in others because of the conviction of the speaker himself. Even those who had heard Lincoln speak over the years were taken aback. When, they asked one another, had he mastered the history of the slavery question so completely? The answer lay in the long period of work, creative introspection, research, and grinding thought that emerged in the wake of his dispiriting time in Congress and his failure to secure the high-ranking position he thought he deserved after sustained party politicking. From that crucible of self-doubt had come an accelerated striving, a self-willed, intellectual, metaphysical, and personal growth. Never again would he assume that his side of the aisle held a monopoly on righteousness. Never again would he deploy satire as a means to vindictively humiliate another. Nothing so much marks a man as bold, imaginative expressions, Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote in his diary, speaking of Socrates and the golden sayings of Pythagoras. A complete statement in the imaginative form of an important truth arrests attention and is respected and remembered. Such oratory will make the reputation of a man. The way Lincoln had learned to use language, the collective story he told, and the depth of his conviction marked a turning point in his reputation as both a man and a leader. A great storyteller will always be rooted in the people, essayist Walter Benjamin writes. It is granted to him to reach back to a whole lifetime, culling from his own experience as well as the experience of others, to unfold narratives that provide counsel, advice, and direction. Such storytellers are teachers and sages, he remarked. Counsel woven into the fabric of real life is wisdom. This was the leadership voice Abraham Lincoln had developed during his long waiting period. Everyone who had known him in earlier years remarked upon changes that had begun to transform him from a local politician and country lawyer into the personage connoted today by the name of Abraham Lincoln. People observed that something large and lasting had happened during this introspective crucible period, something that could be gauged in his appearance and demeanor, his manner of delivery, and his profundity of thought. In the anti-slavery struggle, he had found the great purpose that would thrust him back into public life, and that purpose, larger by far than his large personal ambition, would hold him fast until he died. Two giant strides toward Lincoln's ascension to the presidency were, ironically, his two failed efforts in 1855 and 1858 to become the U.S. Senator from Illinois. In 1855, in a clear-cut surrender of personal ambition to moral principle, Lincoln orchestrated his own defeat to ensure victory for a fellow anti-slavery man over a pro-Nebraska candidate. In January, when the 100-member state legislature convened to choose a new senator, Lincoln was the clear first choice of 47 of the anti-Nebraska Whigs. The candidate of the Douglas Democrats had 41 votes, and a small band of 5 independent Democrats, who had broken from Douglas after the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, held the balance of power. Led by Norman Judd of Chicago, this little band supported Democratic Congressman Lyman Trumbull for senator. A deadlock went on into the night until Lincoln instructed his Whig supporters to vote for Trumbull, fearing that the Douglas Democrat would win. Lincoln's supporters were heartbroken, claiming the unfairness of the 47 men being controlled by the 5. But they followed Lincoln's directive, and Trumbull was elected senator. "The agony is over at last," the chagrined Lincoln wrote a friend. "But the defeat of the Douglas Democrat gives me more pleasure than my own defeat gives me pain." When Lincoln ran in 1858 for the U.S. Senate, he represented the new Republican Party, assembled from the disparate opponents of the Nebraska Bill, anti-slavery Whigs, bolting Democrats, free soilers, abolitionists. As the leader who had fused this fragile coalition in the Prairie State, Abraham Lincoln was the overwhelming choice of Illinois Republicans to oppose the incumbent Democrat, Stephen Douglas. Recalling the generosity Lincoln had exercised 3 years earlier in his first run for the Senate, when he had maneuvered his own defeat to ensure victory for an anti-slavery Democrat, hundreds of party activists stood ready to commit their energies to ensure Lincoln's victory. Lincoln's opening campaign statement offers a clear glimpse into his general blueprint for orienting his followers by gentle education and persuasion. If we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could then better judge what to do and how to do it. With this simple statement, he launched upon a communal storytelling voyage with his audience so they might collectively address a problem and together set about to forge a solution. "A house divided against itself cannot stand," he began, echoing the Gospels of Mark and Matthew, invoking an easily approachable image of the Union as a house in danger of collapse under the pressure of slavery advocates who, by repealing the Missouri Compromise, had jeopardized the integrity of the entire structure. Despite the ominous metaphor of a collapsing house, the tone of Lincoln's speech was positive, exhorting Republicans to recapture control of the nation's building blocks by restoring the laws that prevented the extension of slavery. If slavery were again on a course to eventual extinction, people in all sections could once more live peaceably in the revered house their forefathers had built. All was now in readiness for the historic convergence of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. 7 face-to-face encounters that attracted tens of thousands of people and fastened the attention of tens of millions more who read the full transcripts in leading papers across the country. If it was Douglas, the leading Democrat candidate for the president in 1860, who drew the public and national journalists to the debates, it was Lincoln, then barely known outside his state, who made the lasting impression. "Who is this man that is replying to Douglas in your state?" an Eastern political figure asked an Illinois journalist. "Do you realize that no greater speeches have been made on public questions in the history of our country? That his knowledge of the subject is profound, his logic unanswerable, his style inimitable?" When voters went to the polls that November, Republicans won a popular majority of the statewide vote, for which Lincoln received a great share of the credit. Nonetheless, by means of an unfair and outdated reapportionment scheme, the Democrats retained control of the state legislature, which promptly re-elected Stephen Douglas to the U.S. Senate. Once again, Lincoln's personal aspirations were dashed, but he accepted loss with equanimity. Days later, while the emotions of defeat were still fresh upon him, he wrote dozens of consoling letters to his supporters. Characteristically, it was he who consoled them rather than the other way around. To his friend, Dr. Anson Henry, he wrote, "I am glad I made the late race. It gave me a hearing on the great and durable question of the age, which I could have had in no other way." After hearing that another friend was despondent, Lincoln promised, "You will soon feel better. Another blow-up is coming, and we shall have fun again." The serenity and composure he exhibited were not simply to hearten his followers. Lincoln was in dead earnest. He trusted that this was a temporary loss. The anti-slavery fight not only would continue, it must continue until it was won. No man of this generation has grown more rapidly before the country than Lincoln in this canvass, editorialized the Evening Post as the Senate race came to a close. The knowledge of Lincoln's leadership capacities was rapidly spreading. When a friend suggested that he might well be considered a formidable presidential candidate, however, Lincoln protested, noting that William Henry Seward, Salmon Chase, and others were so much better known. They were the men who had carried this movement forward to its present status. Seward had been New York's youngest governor before his election to the Senate, where his fiery speeches won a passionate following among northern liberals and marked him as the nation's most celebrated anti-slavery politician. Chase, now the first Republican governor of Ohio, had been the Senate leader in the fight against the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act and was one of the founders of the Republican Party. Judge Edward Bates, a widely respected native Virginian who had migrated to Missouri and joined the anti-slavery cause, had a natural constituency among conservatives throughout the North and within the southern tier of the Midwestern states. While recognizing that he had only an outside chance, Lincoln quietly pursued the nomination. From the start, he understood, with a raw political instinct as keen as his ambition, that the only path to his nomination against three celebrated opponents required a combination of relentless determination and self-effacing humility. By holding back, by not thrusting his own candidacy forward, he gained the goodwill of tens of thousands of fellow Republicans by speaking solely on behalf of the party and the Republican cause. And dozens of rousing speeches, delivered in cities and towns throughout the North, from Kansas, Missouri, and Ohio, to New York, Connecticut, and Rhode Island, he beseeched Republicans to put differences aside and unite behind the movement that was their new party. Aware that beyond his home state, he was not the first choice of any, he sought to become the second choice of many. Refusing to disparage his rivals, he aimed to leave their supporters in a mood to come to us if they shall be compelled to give up their first love. As his national renown began to build, so his estimation of his own chances improved. Even as he cast a humorous and skeptical eye on suggestions that he might successfully aspire to the nomination, he had begun to visualize himself as a legitimate contender. In all likelihood, he had been turning over the prospect of a presidential bid long before he made his candidacy known. "No man knows," Lincoln said years later, "when the presidential grub gets to gnawing at him, just how deeply it will get until he has tried it." As the possibility of success became more conceivable, Lincoln redoubled his efforts, working harder than all his opponents combined. While Seward, confident that the nomination was his, traveled through Europe for 8 months prior to the convention, Lincoln labored daily, researching and deepening his speeches, keeping them fresh. As he crafted each speech, he would withdraw into a cocoon, finding a corner in the state library or a back room or small chamber wherever he was speaking. There he could be alone to focus his research, thought, and feeling. At times he employed his closest friends as sounding boards, but the more he traveled the country, the more he relied upon his own perceptions of what he should say and exactly what it would take to win the nomination. Nowhere did the product of such relentless discipline reap greater rewards than at Cooper Union in New York, where he accepted a lecture invitation which Salmon Chase had earlier declined. Understanding the importance of making a strong impression on an audience in Seward's home state, Lincoln spent many weeks extensively researching the attitudes towards slavery of each of the 39 original signers of the Constitution, allowing him to demonstrate that a close reading of their writings and statements revealed that a clear majority had marked slavery as an evil not to be extended, but to be tolerated and protected only because and so far as its actual presence among us makes that toleration and protection a necessity. Accordingly, the new Republicans, Lincoln claimed, were the authentic conservatives, the party closest to the words and intentions of the framers. He reached out to the South, speaking as a mediator, calling for calmness and deliberation as the shrapnel from explosions, the brutal assault on Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner by a Southern congressman, the Supreme Court's Dred Scott decision claiming Negroes were not citizens, and John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry severely lacerated the country. Yet beneath the well-documented, crystalline logic of his argument and the moderate tone he preached, there surged an ardor so profoundly felt that even the more radical members of the audience were shaken. Two major tenets ran through every public statement Lincoln had made since he re-entered public life in 1854. No extension of slavery into the territories. No interference with slavery where it already existed. While Seward, in the months leading up to the convention, endeavored to soften the fiery rhetoric that had delighted abolitionists, and Bates sought to win liberal support by proposing equal constitutional rights for all citizens, Lincoln remained steadfast. His adherence to the two central party tenets placed him precisely on the intersection of the two lines that marked the perfect mean of the extreme elements of the Republican Party. Nor was his avoidance of extremes the result of calculation. It was, the Chicago Daily Press and Tribune pointed out, the natural consequence of an equable nature and a mental constitution that is never off its balance. As the convention opening drew near, and support for Lincoln's candidacy grew stronger, Lincoln himself took nothing for granted. Realizing that a successful bid would require the unanimous support of the Illinois delegation, he worked to bridge the divisions within the state party, openly asking for help from delegates representing different factions in the party. "I am not in a position where it would hurt much for me not to be nominated on the national ticket. But I am where it would hurt some for me to not get the Illinois delegates," he wrote to a politician in the northern part of the state. "Can you not help me in this matter, in your end of the vineyard?" When the state Republicans met in convention 10 days prior to the national convention, they passed a resolution instructing the delegates to vote as a unit for Abraham Lincoln. By contrast, Chase did not lift a finger to ensure a united Ohio delegation, having mistakenly assumed that every delegate would automatically vote for him, given all he had done for the party and the state. No team in Chicago worked harder than Lincoln's team. While some of the intimate circle had political ambitions of their own, most of them, Henry Whitney observed, worked con amore, chiefly from love of the man, his lofty moral tone, his pure political morality. Indeed, two of the key members of Lincoln's team were former Democrats Norman Judd and Lyman Trumbull, whose refusal to cross party lines in 1855 had cost Lincoln his first Senate election. Lincoln's magnanimity, in contrast to the enemies Seward and Chase had created in their climb to power, had brought both men to his side in abiding friendship. When the balloting began, Seward was considered the front runner, followed by Chase and Bates. On the third ballot, however, to the surprise of many, Abraham Lincoln emerged as the nominee. Over the years, people have debated the factors that led to Lincoln's victory. Some have argued that the verdict represented the defeat of Seward rather than the nomination of Lincoln. Others have pointed to luck, that the convention was held in Chicago and that Illinois was a key battleground state. While happenstance played a role in the end, Lincoln's victory was due predominantly to his leadership skills. His shrewd comprehension of the lay of the land, growing confidence in his own judgment and intuition, unmatched work ethic, rhetorical abilities, equable nature, and elevated ambition. He never allowed his ambition to consume his kind-heartedness or to modify his allegiance to the anti-slavery cause. While the delegates may not have recognized the true measure of Lincoln's leadership strengths, events would soon prove that they had chosen the best candidate to lead their new party to victory. From the start, Lincoln discerned that his first task was to unite the candidates he had defeated into a single Republican movement. To that end, he wrote a personal letter to Chase, humbly asking for his especial assistance in the campaign. He dispatched a close friend to St. Louis to beseech Judge Bates to write a public letter on his behalf. And most importantly, he secured Seward's willingness to act as his chief surrogate on the campaign trail. Pursuing a strategic policy of self-restraint, he remained in Springfield throughout the entire campaign, aware that anything he said or wrote would be taken out of context to inflame sectionalism for partisan purposes. He simply pointed to the party platform in his many published speeches when asked about an issue. These carefully crafted documents, he maintained, fully represented his opinions on the central issues of the day. By the fall of 1860, the slavery issue had smashed the Democratic Party much as it had shattered the Whigs. John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry had hardened Southern attitudes. No longer supporting Douglas's popular sovereignty, the Southern wing demanded explicit protection from Congress to bring slaves into the new territories, regardless of the vote of the people. Accordingly, when Douglas became the nominee of the Democratic Party, Southern Democrats walked out and nominated their own candidate, Kentucky Senator John Breckinridge. Before the split, Lincoln told a friend, Republican chances were more than equal. Now, with a divided party, the Democratic chances seemed very slim. Nonetheless, he understood that nothing must be left to chance. Lincoln even agreed, after much hesitation, to write a short autobiography to put some muscle, sinew, and fat onto the bare bones of his scanty resume and help construct a campaign persona. While he refused to sentimentalize the extreme hardships of his frontier childhood, he supplied memories of building his log cabin and splitting the rail fence that surrounded its 10 acres. Soon rails, purportedly split by Lincoln, began surfacing at public gatherings. The emblem caught fire. Rails were embossed on campaign medals, went zigzagging across newspaper cartoons, were motifs in campaign slogans and jingles. While Lincoln never claimed he had split a particular rail presented to him with great fanfare, he acknowledged that he had indeed been a hired laborer, mauling rails at work on a flatboat. Just what might happen to any man's son. The story of his life and his laborious efforts to educate himself made Lincoln into a man of the people, the American dream made flesh. On election day, Lincoln was understandably restless. Struggle had been his birthright, adversity his expectation. When his youthful dream of becoming the DeWitt Clinton of Illinois had been dashed with the spectacular demise of his internal improvement projects, he had fallen into depression. A period of self-doubt and self-assessment had followed his disappointing congressional term. Yet neither of his 2 Senate losses had triggered personal doubt or depression. On the contrary, he considered both defeats positive steps in the advancement of the anti-slavery movement. By then, he was so thoroughly interwoven in the issues before the people, his law partner, William Herndon, observed, that he had become part of them. The inner voice that had anticipated defeat had been stilled by the strength of his belief in the anti-slavery cause. When the returns came in, a jubilant 52-year-old Lincoln learned that he had won. This victory was the culmination of a different ambition than that of a 23-year-old who had striven to bolster his self-worth by the esteem in which he was held by his fellow men. He now emanated the quiet sense of responsibility he had found in his role model, Henry Clay, regarded by all as the man for a crisis. His spoken and written words were pared down, leaner, more measured, cautious, centered, more determined, displaying a rhetoric less hectic, yet no less impassioned than the poetry he had delivered half a lifetime earlier at the Lyceum. He had found his mature voice.
Chapter 6. Theodore Roosevelt. The light has gone out of my life. On the floor of the Albany legislature, Theodore Roosevelt received the joyful telegram that he was now father to his first child, a healthy baby girl. When shortly afterward a second telegram was delivered, all liveliness drained from his being. He rushed from the floor and caught a train to New York City, where his family had congregated to support his wife Alice and celebrate the birth of their child. In the next 6 hours, Roosevelt would be plunged into such an excessive nightmare of grief as to be found only in grand tragedy. "There is a curse on this house," his brother Elliot told him upon his arrival. "Mother is dying, and Alice is dying too." By midnight, both women were in a semi-conscious state. His 49-year-old mother, Mitty, still a youthful-looking, beautiful woman, had been suffering from what was considered to be a severe cold, but which turned out to be a lethal case of typhoid fever. Theodore was at his mother's bedside at 3 a.m. when she died. Less than 12 hours later, as he enfolded his young wife in his arms, Alice died, from what was later diagnosed as acute kidney disease, its symptoms masked by her pregnancy. In his diary that night, the 26-year-old Theodore placed a large X, along with the simple words, "The light has gone out of my life." 2 days later, he recorded, "We spent 3 years of happiness greater and more unalloyed than I have ever known fall to the lot of others. For joy or sorrow, my life has now been lived out." In Albany, the legislature voted unanimously to adjourn until the following Monday night, a marked tribute to the popular assemblyman wholly unprecedented in the legislative annals. At the double funeral service held at the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church, party bosses and dozens of assemblymen were present, along with members of New York society and scores of people who had attended Roosevelt Sr.'s funeral 6 years before. During the service, Theodore appeared to his former tutor, Arthur Cutler, in a dazed, stunned state. He does not know what he does or says. The pastor nearly lost command of his voice, as he noted the peculiar circumstances that made the service especially sorrowful. Two members of the same family, of the same home, were on the same day taken from life and were to be buried together, he said. He did not remember anything like it in the course of his long ministry. In a rare introspective reply to a condolence from his main friend Bill Sewell, Roosevelt revealed what would become a full-blown stoic fatalism. "It was a grim and evil fate, but I have never believed it did any good to flinch or yield for any blow, nor does it lighten the blow to cease from working." 2 days after the funeral, Roosevelt returned to the assembly, telling a friend, "I think I should go mad if I were not employed." "He seemed a changed man," remarked his colleague Isaac Hunt. "From that time on, there was a sadness about his face that he never had before. He did not want anybody to talk to him about it, and did not want anybody to sympathize with him. It was a grief he had in his own soul." To his sister Bammy, to whom he had bequeathed total responsibility for the care and well-being of his newborn daughter, he wrote, "We are now holding evening sessions, and I am glad we are. Indeed, the more we work, the better I like it." He had always applied himself at a pace governed by inordinate energy. Now, driven by the need to mitigate his misery, he lashed himself into a legislative frenzy, pushing one reform bill after another onto the floor, heedless of parliamentary procedure, failing to weigh criticisms of colleagues. It did not take long to squander the political capital which the goodwill and sympathy of the old machine politicians and the young reformers had bestowed upon him after his grievous losses. Before the session came to an end, he made the determination that he could not bear returning to Albany for another legislative term. His career in the state legislature was over. There remained one crusade left to fight, one that gave Roosevelt a temporary sense of purpose, but would ultimately worsen his depression. At the Republican National Convention in June, he led a small but vocal independent group supporting reformer Vermont Senator George Edmunds for president against James G. Blaine, the choice of the party bosses. With good reason, reformers identified Blaine as an emblem of the corrupt moral standards of the post-Civil War Republican Party. While Roosevelt's refusal to support Blaine earned him the bitter and venomous hatred of the political bosses, it gained him widespread admiration among the ranks of reformist Republicans. To many young men, Charles Evans Hughes recalled, Roosevelt seemed to incarnate everything that was noble and worthwhile in politics. He was like a splendid breeze that made everyone feel brighter and better. Roosevelt's reformist zeal failed to carry the delegates. When the votes were finally counted, the bosses prevailed. Blaine trounced Edmunds. "Our defeat is an overwhelming rout," Roosevelt told Bammy. Of all the candidates, I consider Blaine as by far the most objectionable, because his personal honesty as well as his faithfulness as a public servant are both open to questions. That he was victorious speaks badly for the intelligence of the mass of my party. Veteran Republican reformer George William Curtis, who had joined Roosevelt's fight, lamented, "I was at the birth of the Republican Party, and I fear I am to witness its death." The nomination of Blaine led scores of Republican independents to abandon the party. Calling themselves mugwumps, they pledged not only to vote, but to advocate for the Democratic nominee. The independents were certain that Roosevelt would join their ranks. In a state of fury when he left the convention, Roosevelt told a reporter that he could never vote for Blaine and would give hearty support to any upright Democrat. In the weeks that followed, however, he backslid, announcing that, by inheritance and education, he was a Republican, a party man who believed in party government. He had acted with the party in the past and felt obliged to act with it in the future. Not wanting to burn his bridges, he resolved that he would abide by the outcome of the Republican convention. Roosevelt's fellow reformers were stunned. Reform newspapers, which had championed the young legislator, now considered him a traitor to the cause. "Theodore, beware of ambition. By that sin has fallen many another young man as promising as you," warned the Boston Globe. By his actions, Roosevelt had initially angered the bosses. Now, he enraged the independents, betrayed by his reversal and subsequent support for Blaine. "I have very little expectation of being able to keep in politics," he told a New York journalist. "I cannot regret enough the unfortunate turn in political affairs that has practically debarred me from taking any part in the fray," he admitted to his friend, Massachusetts Representative Henry Cabot Lodge. "I think it will be a good many years before I get back into politics," he despaired in a letter to his sister Bammy. Feeling the need to escape from the catastrophe that beset his private life and the untenable political crisis in which he had bound himself, Roosevelt headed for the Badlands, where he had purchased a ranch the previous year. "I am going cattle ranching in Dakota for the remainder of the summer and a part of the fall," he told a reporter who was harassing him. "What I shall do after that, I cannot tell." Even then, jilted reformers were not appeased. "No ranch or other hiding place in the world can shield a man who backs a man like Blaine," the Evening Post scornfully observed. "Punching cattle is the best way to avoid campaigning," was Roosevelt's unhappy rejoinder. So began a sojourn on the western frontier he would come to regard as the most important educational asset of his entire life. When asked 2 decades later which chapter of his life he would choose to remember, including the presidency, he said, "I would take the memory of my life on the ranch, with its experiences close to nature and among the men who lived nearest her." During this western interlude, Roosevelt would gather material for the most accomplished writing ventures of his life, hunting trips of a ranchman, ranch life and the hunting trail, and the winning of the West. But by far, the greatest and most enduring of the projects during these months and years of reaction to the trauma he had experienced was the work of his own healing, growth, and self-transformation. In selecting the 4-member team to manage his ranching operations, Roosevelt revealed the characteristic sure touch with which he would choose associates in the years ahead. After spending only 2 weeks with Bill Merrifield and Sylvain Ferris during his hunting trip the previous fall, he had determined on the spot to trust them with $40,000, one-third of the money his father had bequeathed him, to buy and tend 1,000 head of cattle. To partner with him in the daily operation of the ranch, he chose his main guide, Bill Sewell, and Sewell's nephew, Will Dow. Neither man had prior experience with cattle ranching. That made small difference to Roosevelt. Astutely reading the character of both men, he guaranteed them a share of anything the new enterprise might earn, while promising that he would absorb any losses. He also invited them to live with him in the ranch house they would together design and build. "He never was a man to hesitate to make a decision," Sewell recalled years later. Once he could discern a streak of honor in a man, that man could be trusted. When Roosevelt first got to the Dakotas, Sewell recounted, he was very melancholy, very much down in spirits. The landscape of the Badlands, its lonely plains, open spaces, and haunting beauty, mirrored the desolation of his inner landscape. With Sewell, as with few people, Roosevelt expressed his feelings, confessing that he felt as if it did not make any difference what became of him. He had nothing to live for. Sewell suggested he had his daughter to live for, but Roosevelt countered that his sister was better positioned to take care of the child. "She would be just as well off without me." Just as he had driven himself to exhaustion in Albany in the weeks after Alice's death, so now, with reckless abandon and headlong intensity, he punished himself with the hardest and most dangerous work of the cowboys, as if, through excitement and fear, he might retrieve the possibility of feeling alive once again. He rode his horse 16 hours a day, galloped at top speed over rugged terrain, hunted black-tailed deer, antelope, elk, and buffalo, and joined in the frenzied 5-week roundups when the cattle were branded and gathered for market. By flinging himself into every aspect of the daily lives of the cowboys, Roosevelt was not playing cowboy. He was a cowboy. The daily work of the ranch, companionship with his fellow cowboys, and the sustained pursuit of his writing endeavors distracted him from overthought, and he was finally able to sleep at night. "Black care," he wrote, "rarely sits behind a rider whose pace is fast enough." The young reformers in the East, who had once idolized Roosevelt, knew nothing about this immersion in the West. "We only knew that the man who seemed to have the brightest opportunity and the most splendid career opening had disappeared," Charles Evans Hughes said, "and apparently had disappeared in absolute failure. He was out of politics altogether. He was no longer apparently available for anything. He had gone away, and it seemed like a candlelight that had been snuffed out, mistaken for some luminary which was ever to be the guide." But Theodore Roosevelt was neither a snuffed candle, nor had he altogether abandoned politics. He had retreated west, seeking in a state of nature not gentle balm, but a test, a strenuous challenge, where he might confront his deadened heart and fear of intimacy, and somehow renew confidence in himself, and in a future where he might become a genuine luminary, guide, and leader. And as the seasons passed, his depression slowly began to lift. By the end of his 2-year hiatus, Roosevelt had emerged from his traumatic ordeal stronger in body and resurgent in spirit. Though he would periodically suffer from asthma the rest of his life, he had improved his lungs in the cool mountain air and developed a more muscular chest. When he first arrived, Sewell recalled, he was a frail young man, troubled by bouts of breathlessness and chronic stomach pains. When he got back into the world, he was as husky as any man I have ever seen who wasn't dependent on his arms for his livelihood. He had gained 30 pounds and was clear bone, muscle, and grit. The falsetto voice, which failed to make an echo in the legislative chamber, was now hearty and strong enough to drive oxen. Transforming his body was but one step in the psychological struggle to overcome what Theodore still considered his own nervous and timid nature. When he arrived in the West, he acknowledged, "There were all kinds of things of which I was afraid at first, from grizzly bears to mean horses and gunfighters, but by acting as if I was not afraid, I gradually ceased to be afraid." While some men, he observed, were naturally fearless, He had to train his soul and spirit as well as his body. So constantly forcing himself to do the difficult or even dangerous thing, he gradually was able to cultivate courage as a matter of habit, in the sense of repeated effort and repeated exercise of willpower. Though only a mediocre horseman, he volunteered to ride mean horses, those liable to buck. As the owner of the ranch, he wanted to set a leadership example, even at the cost, on several risky occasions, of breaking his ribs. Similarly, while poor eyesight prevented his becoming a crack shot, he nevertheless joined professional hunters in the hazardous pursuit of bear, antelope, and buffalo. Perseverance, he insisted, was the key to his success as both a hunter and a cowboy. With endless practice, he learned to shoot at a moving target with the same accuracy as at a stationary one. Years of studying animals allowed him to identify, track, and anticipate the behavior patterns of his prey. He hoped his example of acquired courage would prove instructive, persuading other men that if they could consider danger as something to be faced and overcome, they would become fearless by sheer dint of practicing fearlessness. So completely was he able to surmount his own fears that in the years ahead, countless observers made reference to the indomitable courage that seemed to them clearly ingrained in his being. In this 2-year interval, Roosevelt had recast himself as a new kind of American man, a hybrid of the cultivated Easterner and the hard-bitten Westerner. Without his extended stay in the Badlands, his sister Corinne suggested, he would never have been able to interpret the spirit of the West as he did. For the rest of his life, countless countrymen regarded him as a man of the West, a romantic figure far removed from his upper-class background. He reveled in the knowledge that opponents could no longer describe him as a dude or a dandy. A cult of personality had taken root. Simply put, Roosevelt later said, I would not have been president had it not been for my experience in North Dakota. There are points of likeness in the seminal disasters that befell both Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt in the early stages of their careers. Both crucibles were precipitated by a combination of intimate personal crises and public repudiation that seemed to crush their core ambitions. Both swore off politics, or at least paid lip service to deserting politics forever. Both suffered severe depressions. Healing change had to come from within, while they waited for the historical kaleidoscope to turn. Yet the two men dealt with their depressions in contrasting manners, ways congruent with their very different dispositions. Lincoln opened to grief and melancholy, sharing his feelings with neighbors, colleagues, and friends. Roosevelt closed down completely. He repressed his emotions, abandoned his daughter, and refused even to speak her given name, Alice, the name of his deceased wife. He referred to her simply as Baby Lee, confessing, "There can never be another Alice to me." Nor could he bear reminiscing about his courtship and brief marriage. He destroyed almost all the pictures, letters, and mementos of their shared past. It was both weak and morbid, he insisted, to dwell on loss. As Roosevelt's spirits revived, his thoughts returned eastward to the home and friends left behind. On a short visit to New York in the fall of 1885, he encountered Edith Corot, the highly intelligent, intensely private young woman who had once been his closest childhood friend. As a 5-year-old, Edith had joined Theodore and his sister Corinne in the homeschool Theodore Sr. had established in the family's 20th Street household. In the summers, she had been a frequent guest at the family's Long Island estate. There, she and Theodore had become inseparable buddies. Together, they discovered a first love of literature, explored nature, rode trails on horseback, and sailed in the bay. As adolescents, they were dancing partners at cotillions and familiar companions at social events. In the summer before Theodore met Alice, however, the young couple had an enigmatic falling out. what Theodore termed their very intimate relations, were suddenly terminated. Edith later confessed that she had loved Theodore with all the passion of a girl who had never loved before, and that when he married Alice, she was certain she would never love again. The chance meeting in 1885 revived long-hidden feelings in the conflicted widower as well, and in the ensuing months they met whenever he was in New York and regularly wrote when they were apart. If Theodore's devotion to Edith Carew lacked the churning romantic sentimentalism of his passion for Alice, his marriage to Edith provided his tempestuous nature with a life-sustaining stability and sanctuary. By the summer of 1886, 2 years after he had fled to the West, Roosevelt was ready to re-enter the political world. Life as a literary cowboy had been a formative respite, but it was never able to gratify his grand ambitions. "I would like a chance at something I thought I could really do," he told his friend, Massachusetts Representative Henry Cabot Lodge. He was ready to test himself again in the public arena, the world for which he was born and bred. The loss of his wife and mother on the same day became more than a catastrophic landmark in Theodore Roosevelt's personal life. The brutal twist of fate reshaped his philosophy of leadership as well. It underscored the vulnerability, fragility, and mutability of all his endeavors, political and personal. Career objectives now seemed air-drawn, subject to dissolving or reversing in a moment's time. Following that gruesome February day, chance, good luck and bad, would be deemed the trump card in his deck. This basic fatalism helps explain what might otherwise seem a haphazard choice of career opportunities during the next decade. Shortly after returning home, he entered and lost a race for mayor of New York, despite his belief, given the city's overwhelming Democratic majority, that it was a perfectly hopeless contest. After campaigning vigorously for the victorious 1888 presidential campaign of Republican Benjamin Harrison, Roosevelt had hoped to be appointed Assistant Secretary of State, but was finally offered a relatively minor federal post as one of 3 members of the Civil Service Commission. Roosevelt's friends urged him to decline, worried that the obscure position far beneath his standing and reputation would bury him in oblivion. To their bewilderment, however, Roosevelt eagerly accepted, and furthermore remained at the post for an astonishing total of 6 years. When the opportunity to return to his home state was presented, Roosevelt resigned to become one of 4 New York Police Board members, a thankless job fraught with political peril. 3 years later, after stumping for the victorious Republican candidate William McKinley in the fall of 1896, he was offered Assistant Secretary of the Navy, a post his friends again felt below what he deserved. Yet, once again he accepted, remaining at the Navy Department until the outbreak of the Spanish-American War, at which point, yet again counter to friends' advice, he resigned to volunteer in the Army. What had become of the singular ascending ambition that had driven young Roosevelt from his earliest days? What explains his willingness, against the counsel of his most trusted friends, to accept seemingly low-level jobs that traced neither a clear-cut nor a reliably ascending career path? The answer lies in probing what Roosevelt gleaned from his crucible experience. His expectation of and belief in a smooth, upward trajectory, either in life or in politics, was gone forever. He questioned if leadership success could be obtained by attaching oneself to a series of titled positions. If a person focused too much on a future that could not be controlled, he would become, Roosevelt acknowledged, too careful, calculating, cautious in word and act. Thereafter, he would jettison long-term career calculations and focus simply on whatever job opportunity came his way, assuming it might be his last. "Do what you can, with what you have, where you are," he liked to say. In a very real way, Roosevelt had come to see political life as a succession of crucibles, good or bad, able to crush or elevate. He would view each position as a test of character, effort, endurance, and will. He would keep nothing in reserve for some will-o'-the-wisp future. Rather, he would regard each job as a pivotal test, a manifestation of his leadership skills. Roosevelt's crucible experience had heightened his awareness of mortality, drastically reducing the span he felt remaining for him to live and fulfill his ambitions. His intensified sense of passing time, his awareness that life could turn on a dime, made him impatient, sometimes unbearably so, to get things accomplished. The hectic speed with which he had introduced dozens of bills in the legislature following Alice's death became a lifelong pattern, a confrontational and often abrasive mode of leadership that put him at odds with the established procedures and the sluggish metabolism of any bureaucratic institution. When Roosevelt was later asked how he was able to successfully lead such disparate departments as the Civil Service Commission, the New York Police Department, and the Navy Department, he insisted that the challenges he faced did not necessitate administrative genius or even any unusual qualities, but just common sense, common honesty, energy, resolution, and readiness to learn. While this analysis may sound banal or disingenuously modest, Roosevelt's leadership style was, in actuality, governed by just such a series of simple dictums and aphorisms. Hit the ground running. Consolidate control. Ask questions of everyone wherever you go. Manage by wandering around. Determine the basic problems of each organization and hit them head on. When attacked, counterattack. Stick to your guns. Spend your political capital to reach your goals. And then, when your work is stymied or done, find a way out. Friends who had urged Roosevelt to turn down the unheralded post of Civil Service Commissioner failed to comprehend what Roosevelt himself instinctively grasped, that the fight to enforce the controversial new civil service law represented a signature battle in the war against corruption, a battle ideally suited for this son of a reform-minded philanthropist with his own outsized crusading temperament. The Pendleton Civil Service Reform Act, passed in the wake of President James Garfield's murder, the assassin a disappointed patronage seeker, was designed to replace the reigning spoils system with a merit system based on competitive examinations. Roosevelt regarded the spoils system as a cynical corruption of the democratic idea that every man should be judged on his merits. It treats all offices, he argued, as prizes to be scrambled for by the smirched victors in a contemptible struggle for political plunder, as bribes to be parceled out among the most active and influential henchmen of the various party leaders. He vowed to make the commission a living force. He intended to enforce the new law to the fullest, to thwart anyone, including leaders in his own party, who were doing everything in their power to halt the progress of reform and hamper the execution of the law. Roosevelt understood from the start that he would have a hard row to hoe. The spoils system was the heartbeat of machine politics. No sooner had he arrived at the Civil Service Commission than he signaled that business as usual no longer applied. To hit the ground running, to dramatize the change in direction, he launched an unexpected raid on the powerful New York Custom House, where rumor suggested violations of the new law were rampant. Questioning employees, he gleaned that government clerks were selling examination questions to favored party candidates for fees of $50 to $100. After hearing testimony, taking affidavits, and examining documents, Roosevelt demanded the immediate dismissal of three guilty employees, serving unmistakable notice in the press and before the public that the new law was going to be enforced without fear or favor. His investigation also uncovered that party leaders continued to extort so-called voluntary contributions from Custom House employees as the price for retaining jobs. he walked the corridors to directly engage with low-level office holders, clerks, copyists, letter carriers, and the like. They disclosed how hard it was to meet the party leader's demand for 2% of their salary. The winter assessment, he dramatically noted in a blistering report summarizing the investigation, might mean the difference between having and not having a winter overcoat for himself, or a warm dress for his wife. To see the problem in terms of the concrete seasonal needs of the poor provided the public with an immediate comprehension of the real meaning of civil service reform. Less than a month later, having heard that postmasters in several cities were manipulating examination scores to appoint favored party members, he set forth on an investigatory tour of post offices. This change in direction, hampered by interminable wrangles among a three-headed commission, prompted him to consolidate power. He seized leadership, took responsibility directly on his shoulders, and executed what was essentially an unacknowledged coup. Not the last time he would make an inaugural move to strengthen his authority. His colleagues were quiet men, the Philadelphia Record observed of his fellow civil service commissioners. It was Roosevelt who did the fighting in the newspapers and before Congress and everywhere else, and of course bore the brunt of the consequent attack. Swiftly he became the public face of the commission. "My two colleagues are away, and I have all the work of the Civil Service Commission to myself," he crowed to his sister Bammy. "I like it. It is more satisfactory than having a divided responsibility, and it enables me to take more decided steps." Not surprisingly, Roosevelt's seizure angered Republican Party bosses, produced friction with colleagues, and elicited sporadic criticisms in the press. He came into official office with a blare of trumpets and a beating of gongs, blared and beat by himself, the Washington Post observed. He immediately announced himself the one man competent to take charge of the entire business of the government. Another critic recommended that he put a padlock on his restless and uncontrollable jaws. But he kept talking. "Mr. Roosevelt is a young Lochinvar," the Boston Evening Times remarked. "He isn't afraid of the newspapers, he isn't afraid of losing his place, and he is always ready for a fight. He keeps civil service reform before the people, and, as the case often is, his aggressiveness is a great factor in a good cause." By the time Roosevelt left the commission, his leadership had stoked such public support for the new civil service law that open violations were no longer tolerated. A true merit system was actually in the process of being born, so that, as Jacob Riis summarized, the fellow with no pull should have an even chance with his rival who came backed, that the farmer's lad and the mechanic's son, who had no one to speak for them, should have the same show in competing for public service as the son of wealth and social prestige. Any man who has been successful, Roosevelt repeatedly said, has leapt at opportunities chance provides. In the fall of 1894, a series of exposés, most notably involving Tammany's unscrupulous relationships with the city's police department, had compromised the Democratic Party's traditional hold on city politics. A defiant mood of reform was in the air. In the wake of the scandals, a reform-minded Republican businessman, William Strong, was elected mayor. Not long after he was sworn in, he offered Roosevelt the most challenging job in his administration, police commissioner, chief of the four-man police board. Roosevelt accepted without hesitation. "I have the most important and the most corrupt department in New York on my hands," Roosevelt wrote about the difficulties ahead, the note of excitement loud and piercing. Using many of the same leadership techniques he had devised and utilized in his 6 years' war as civil service commissioner, Roosevelt wasted no time heralding the fact that regime change had transpired. He literally hit the ground running, racing up the steps of the Mulberry Street police headquarters in order to dramatize for the reporters in his wake that accelerated activity would henceforth mark the police board. "It was all breathless and sudden," one reporter recalled. Still jogging along, Roosevelt fired off questions. Which higher officials should be consulted? Which ones ignored? Which ones punished? What were the customs, rules, methods of the police board? What do we do first? In truth, Roosevelt needed no suggestions on what to do first. On the police board sat two Democrats and two Republicans. Roosevelt had agreed to accept Strong's offer on the condition that he be made head of the board. His preordained election was the first order of business. To Roosevelt's mind, the structure of the four-member board portended unmitigated mischief. Power, in most positions, he believed, should be concentrated in the hands of one man. This might signify the fairly bold credo of a dictator, except for the major caveat Roosevelt added. So long as that man could be held fully responsible for the exercise of that power by the people. While his election as chief helped Roosevelt to consolidate power, this time, in contrast to his experience with the Civil Service Commission, board members proved less pliable. "Thinks he's the whole board," complained Democrat Andrew Parker. "He talks, talks, talks all the time. Scarcely a day passes when there is not something from him in the papers." Politically at odds and filled with personal animosity, Parker failed to understand that for Roosevelt, publicity was not merely the craving to bask in the focused glare of public attention. Public sentiment was his single most potent instrument for driving change. Roosevelt clearly understood that he had much to learn about the machinations of the police department, and he had to learn at once. He turned for guidance to veteran police reporters Jacob Riis and Lincoln Steffens. Roosevelt could not have found two more valuable mentors. Roosevelt had read Riis's first book, How the Other Half Lives, a devastating depiction of the daily struggles of the poor in the immigrant ghettos of New York. So shaken was Roosevelt by this path-breaking tour de force that he set out to find Riis in his office. Riis was absent, but Roosevelt left a card with a scribbled message saying, "I've come to help." Thus began a lifelong friendship between the two men that blossomed during Roosevelt's tenure as police commissioner. "For 2 years," Riis recalled, "we were to be together all the day and quite often most of the night in the environment in which I had spent 20 years of my life. And these two were the happiest by far of them all. Then was life really worth living." While Roosevelt's relationship with the immensely ambitious, self-confident Steffens was both less profound and less durable, he benefited greatly from this talented reporter who had covered the state legislature's stunning probe of police department corruption for the Evening Post and was now head of the Post's police bureau. With solid information and advice provided by Riis and Steffens, the new police commissioner felt equipped to launch.